The average national income per capita is simply the amount that one could distribute to each individual if it were possible to equalize the income distribution without altering total output or national income. Similarly, private per capita wealth on the order of 180,000 euros, or 6 years of national income, does not mean that everyone owns that much capital. Many people have much less, while some own millions or tens of millions of euros worth of capital assets. Much of the population has very little accumulated wealth, significantly less than 1 year's income, a few thousand euros in a bank account, the equivalent of a few weeks or months' worth of wages. Some people even have negative wealth. In other words, the goods they own are worth less than the debts they owe. By contrast, others have considerable fortunes, ranging from 10 to 20 times their annual income, or even more. The capital-income ratio for the country as a whole tells us nothing about inequalities within the country. But Beta does measure the overall importance of capital in a society. So, analyzing this ratio is a necessary first step in the study of inequality. The main purpose of Part 2 is to understand how and why the capital-income ratio varies from country to country, and how it has evolved over time. To appreciate the concrete form that wealth takes in today's world, it is useful to note that the capital stock in the developed countries currently consists of two roughly equal shares: residential capital and professional capital used by firms and government. To sum up, each citizen of one of the wealthy countries earned an average of 30,000 euros per year in 2010, owned approximately 180,000 euros of capital, 90,000 in the form of a dwelling, and another 90,000 in stocks, bonds, savings, or other investments. There are interesting variations across countries, which I will analyze in Chapter 2. For now, the fact that capital can be divided into two roughly equal shares will be useful to keep in mind. The first fundamental law of capitalism: alpha equals R times beta. I can now present the first fundamental law of capitalism, which links the capital stock to the flow of income from capital. The capital-income ratio, beta, is related in a simple way to the share of income from capital in national income, denoted alpha. The formula is alpha equals R times beta, where R is the rate of return on capital. For example, if beta equals 600% and R equals 5%, then alpha equals R times beta equals 30%. In other words, if national wealth represents the equivalent of 6 years of national income, and if the rate of return on capital is 5% per year, then capital's share in national income is 30%. The formula alpha equals R times beta is a pure accounting identity. It can be applied to all societies in all periods of history by definition. Though tautological, it should nevertheless be regarded as the first fundamental law of capitalism, because it expresses a simple, transparent relationship among the three most important concepts for analyzing the capitalist system: the capital-income ratio, the share of capital in income, and the rate of return on capital. The rate of return on capital is a central concept in many economic theories. In particular, Marxist analysis emphasizes the falling rate of profit, a historical prediction that turned out to be quite wrong, although it does contain an interesting intuition. The concept of the rate of return on capital also plays a central role in many other theories. In any case, the rate of return on capital measures the yield on capital over the course of a year, regardless of its legal form. Profits, rents, dividends, interest, royalties, capital gains, etc., expressed as a percentage of the value of capital invested. It is therefore a broader notion than the rate of profit, and much broader than the rate of interest, while incorporating both. Obviously, the rate of return can vary widely, depending on the type of investment. Some firms generate rates of return greater than 10% per year. Others make losses, negative rate of return. The average long-run rate of return on stocks is 7 to 8% in many countries. Investments in real estate and bonds frequently return 3 to 4%, while the real rate of interest on public debt is sometimes much lower. The formula alpha equals R times beta tells us nothing about these subtleties, but it does tell us how to relate these three quantities, which can be useful for framing discussion. For example, in the wealthy countries around 2010, income from capital, profits, interests, dividends, rents, etc., generally hovered around 30% of national income. With a capital income ratio on the order of 600%, this meant that the rate of return on capital was around 5%. Concretely, this means that the current per capita national income of 30,000 euros per year in rich countries breaks down as 21,000 euros per year income from labor, 70%, and 9,000 euros income from capital, 30%. Each citizen owns an average of 180,000 euros of capital, and the 9,000 euros of income from capital thus corresponds to an average annual return on capital of 5%. Once again, I am speaking here only of averages. Some individuals receive far more than 9,000 euros per year in income from capital, while others receive nothing while paying rent to their landlords and interest to their creditors. Considerable country-to-country variation also exists. In addition, measuring the share of income from capital is often difficult in both a conceptual and a practical sense, because there are some categories of income, such as non-wage self-employment income and entrepreneurial income, that are hard to break down into income from capital and income from labor. In some cases, this can make comparison misleading. When such problems arise, the least imperfect method of measuring the capital share of income may be to apply a plausible average rate of return to the capital income ratio. At this stage, the orders of magnitude given above, beta equals 600%, alpha equals 30%, R equals 5%, may be taken as typical. For the sake of concreteness, let us note, too, that the average rate of return on land in rural societies is typically on the order of 4 to 5%. In the novels of Jane Austen and Honoré de Balzac, the fact that land, like government bonds, yields roughly 5% of the amount of capital invested, or equivalently, that the value of capital corresponds to roughly 20 years of annual rent, is so taken for granted that it often goes unmentioned. Contemporary readers were well aware that it took capital on the order of 1 million francs to produce an annual rent of 50,000 francs. For 19th century novelists and their readers, the relation between capital and annual rent was self-evident, and the two measuring scales were used interchangeably, as if rent and capital were synonymous, or perfect equivalents in two different languages. Now, at the beginning of the 21st century, we find roughly the same return on real estate, 4 to 5%, sometimes a little less, especially where prices have risen rapidly without dragging rents upward at the same rate. For example, in 2010, a large apartment in Paris, valued at 1 million euros, typically rents for slightly more than 2,500 euros per month, or annual rent of 30,000 euros, which corresponds to a return on capital of only 3% per year from the landlord's point of view. Such a rent is nevertheless quite high for a tenant living solely on income from labor. One hopes he or she is paid well, while it represents a significant income for the landlord. The bad news, or good news, depending on your point of view, is that things have always been like this. This type of rent tends to rise until the return on capital is around 4%. Which in this example would correspond to a rent of 3,000 to 3,500 euros per month, or 40,000 per year. Hence, this tenant's rent is likely to rise in the future. The landlord's annual return on investment may eventually be enhanced by a long-term capital gain on the value of the apartment. Smaller apartments yield a similar or perhaps slightly higher return. An apartment valued at 100,000 euros may yield 400 euros a month in rent, or nearly 5,000 per year, 5%. A person who owns such an apartment and chooses to live in it can save the rental equivalent and devote that money to other uses, which yields a similar return on investment. Capital invested in businesses is, of course, at greater risk, so the average return is often higher. The stock market capitalization of listed companies in various countries generally represents 12 to 15 years of annual profits, which corresponds to an annual return on investment of 6 to 8% before taxes. The formula alpha equals r times beta allows us to analyze the importance of capital for an entire country, or even for the planet as a whole. It can also be used to study the accounts of a specific company. For example, take a firm that uses capital valued at 5 million euros, including offices, infrastructure, machinery, etc., to produce 1 million euros worth of goods annually, with 600,000 euros going to pay workers and 400,000 euros in profits. The capital income ratio of the company is beta equals 5. Its capital is equivalent to 5 years of output. The capital share alpha is 40%, and the rate of return on capital is R equals 8%. Imagine another company that uses less capital, 3 million euros, to produce the same output, 1 million euros, but using more labor, 700,000 euros in wages, 300,000 in profits. For this company, beta equals 3, alpha equals 30%, and R equals 10%. The second firm is less capital intensive than the first, but it is more profitable. The rate of return on its capital is significantly higher. In all countries, the magnitudes of beta, alpha, and R vary a great deal from company to company. Some sectors are more capital intensive than others. For example, the metal and energy sectors are more capital intensive than the textile and food processing sectors, and the manufacturing sector is more capital intensive than the service sector. There are also significant variations between firms in the same sector, depending on their choice of production technology and market position. The levels of beta, alpha, and R in a given country also depend on the relative shares of residential real estate and natural resources in total capital. It bears emphasizing that the law alpha equals R times beta does not tell us how each of these three variables is determined, or in particular how the national capital income ratio, beta, is determined, the latter being in some sense a measure of how intensely capitalistic the society in question is. To answer that question, we must introduce additional ideas and relationships, in particular, the savings and investment rates and the rate of growth. This will lead us to the second fundamental law of capitalism. The higher the savings rate and the lower the growth rate, the higher the capital income ratio, beta. This will be shown in the next few chapters. At this stage, the law alpha equals R times beta simply means that regardless of what economic, social, and political forces determine the level of the capital income ratio, beta, capital's share in income, alpha, and the rate of return on capital, R, these three variables are not independent of one another. Conceptually, there are 2 degrees of freedom, not 3. National accounts, an evolving social construct. Now that the key concepts of output and income, capital and wealth, capital income ratio, and rate of return on capital have been explained, I will examine in greater detail how these abstract quantities can be measured and what such measurements can tell us about the historical evolution of the distribution of wealth in various countries. I will briefly review the main stages in the history of national accounts and then present a portrait in broad brushstrokes of how the global distribution of output and income has changed since the 18th century, along with a discussion of how demographic and economic growth rates have changed over the same period. These growth rates will play an important part in the analysis. As noted, the first attempts to measure national income and capital date back to the late 17th and early 18th century. Around 1700, several isolated estimates appeared in Britain and France, apparently independently of one another. I am speaking primarily of the work of William Petty, 1664, and Gregory King, 1696, for England, and Pierre Le Pezon, Sieur de Bois-Guilbert, 1695, and Sébastien Le Preste de Vauban, 1707, for France. Their work focused on both the national stock of capital and the annual flow of national income. One of their primary objectives was to calculate the total value of land, by far the most important source of wealth in the agrarian societies of the day, and then to relate the quantity of landed wealth to the level of agricultural output and land rents. It is worth noting that these authors often had a political objective in mind, generally having to do with modernization of the tax system. By calculating the nation's income and wealth, they hoped to show the sovereign that it would be possible to raise tax receipts considerably while keeping tax rates relatively low, provided that all property and goods produced were subject to taxation and everyone was required to pay, including landlords of both aristocratic and common descent. This objective is obvious in Vauban's Projet de Dîme Royale, Plan for a Royal Tithe, but it is just as clear in the works of Bois-Guilbert and King, though less so in Petty's writing. The late 18th century saw further attempts to measure income and wealth, especially around the time of the French Revolution. Antoine Lavoisier published his estimates for the year 1789 in his book La Richesse Territoriale du Royaume de France, The Territorial Wealth of the Kingdom of France, published in 1791. The new tax system established after the Revolution, which ended the privileges of the nobility and imposed a tax on all property and land, was largely inspired by this work, which was widely used to estimate expected receipts from new taxes. It was above all in the 19th century, however, that estimates of national wealth proliferated. From 1870 to 1900, Robert Giffen regularly updated his estimates of Britain's stock of national capital, which he compared to estimates by other authors, especially Patrick Cahoon from the early 1800s. Giffen marveled at the size of Britain's stock of industrial capital, as well as the stock of foreign assets acquired since the Napoleonic Wars, which was many times larger than the entire public debt due to those wars. In France, at about the same time, Alfred de Fauville and Clément Colson published estimates of national wealth and private wealth, and, like Giffen, both writers also marveled at the considerable accumulation of private capital over the course of the 19th century. It was glaringly obvious to everyone that private fortunes were prospering in the period 1870 to 1914. For the economists of the day, the problem was to measure that wealth and compare different countries. The Franco-British rivalry was never far from their minds. Until World War I, estimates of wealth received much more attention than estimates of income and output. And there were, in any case, more of them, not only in Britain and France, but also in Germany, the United States, and other industrial powers. In those days, being an economist meant first and foremost being able to estimate the national capital of one's country. This was almost a rite of initiation. It was not until the period between the two world wars that national accounts began to be established on an annual basis. Previous estimates had always focused on isolated years, with successive estimates separated by 10 or more years, as in the case of Giffen's calculations of British national capital in the 19th century. In the 1930s, improvements in the primary statistical sources made the first annual series of national income data possible. These generally went back as far as the beginning of the 20th century, or the last decades of the 19th. They were established for the United States by Kuznets and Kendrick, for Britain by Bowley and Clark, and for France by Duguay de Bernonville. After World War II, government statistical offices supplanted economists and began to compile and publish official annual data on GDP and national income. These official series continue to this day. Compared with the pre-World War I period, however, the focal point of the data had changed entirely. From the 1940s on, the primary motivation was to respond to the trauma of the Great Depression, during which governments had no reliable annual estimates of economic output. There was therefore a need for statistical and political tools in order to steer the economy properly and avoid a repeat of the catastrophe. Governments thus insisted on annual or even quarterly data on output and income. Estimates of national wealth, which had been so prized before 1914, now took a back seat, especially after the economic and political chaos of 1914 to 1945 made it difficult to interpret their meaning. Specifically, the prices of real estate and financial assets fell to extremely low levels, so low that private capital seemed to have evaporated. In the 1950s and 1960s, a period of reconstruction, the main goal was to measure the remarkable growth of output in various branches of industry. In the 1990s to 2000s, wealth accounting again came to the fore. Economists and political leaders were well aware that the financial capitalism of the 21st century could not be properly analyzed with the tools of the 1950s and 1960s. In collaboration with central banks, government statistical agencies in various developed countries compiled and published annual series of data on the assets and liabilities of different groups, in addition to the usual income and output data. These wealth accounts are still far from perfect. For example, natural capital and damages to the environment are not well accounted for. Nevertheless, they represent real progress in comparison with national accounts from the early post-war years, which were concerned solely with endless growth in output. These are the official series that I use in this book to analyze aggregate wealth and the current capital-income ratio in the wealthy countries. One conclusion stands out in this brief history of national accounting. National accounts are a social construct in perpetual evolution. They always reflect the preoccupations of the era when they were conceived. We should be careful not to make a fetish of the published figures. When a country's national income per capita is said to be 30,000 euros, it is obvious that this number, like all economic and social statistics, should be regarded as an estimate, a construct, and not a mathematical certainty. It is simply the best estimate we have. National accounts represent the only consistent, systematic attempt to analyze a country's economic activity. They should be regarded as a limited and imperfect research tool, a compilation and arrangement of data from highly disparate sources. In all developed countries, national accounts are currently compiled by government statistical offices and central banks from the balance sheets and account books of financial and non-financial corporations, together with many other statistical sources and surveys. We have no reason to think a priori that the officials involved in these efforts do not do their best to spot inconsistencies in the data in order to achieve the best possible estimates. Provided we use these data with caution and in a critical spirit, and complement them with other data where there are errors or gaps, say in dealing with tax havens, these national accounts are an indispensable tool for estimating aggregate income and wealth. In particular, as I will show in Part 2, we can put together a consistent analysis of the historical evolution of the capital income ratio by meticulously compiling and comparing national wealth estimates by many authors from the 18th to the early 20th century and connecting them up with official capital accounts from the late 20th and early 21st century. The other major limitation of official national accounts, apart from their lack of historical perspective, is that they are deliberately concerned only with aggregates and averages and not with distributions and inequalities. We must therefore draw on other sources to measure the distribution of income and wealth and to study inequalities. National accounts thus constitute a crucial element of our analyses, but only when completed with additional historical and distributional data. the global distribution of production. I begin by examining the evolution of the global distribution of production, which is relatively well known from the early 19th century on. For earlier periods, estimates are more approximate, but we know the broad outlines, thanks most notably to the historical work of Angus Maddison, especially since the overall pattern is relatively simple. From 1900 to 1980, 70 to 80% of the global production of goods and services was concentrated in Europe and America, which incontestably dominated the rest of the world. By 2010, the European-American share had declined to roughly 50%, or approximately the same level as in 1860. In all probability, it will continue to fall and may go as low as 20 to 30% at some point in the 21st century. This was the level maintained up to the turn of the 19th century, and would be consistent with the European-American share of the world's population. See PDF figures 1.1 and 1.2. In other words, the lead that Europe and America achieved during the Industrial Revolution allowed these two regions to claim a share of global output that was 2 to 3 times greater than their share of the world's population, simply because their output per capita was 2 to 3 times greater than the global average. All signs are that this phase of divergence in per capita output is over, and that we have embarked on a period of convergence. The resulting catch-up phenomenon is far from over, however. See PDF figure 1.3. It is far too early to predict when it might end, especially since the possibility of economic and/or political reversals in China and elsewhere obviously cannot be ruled out. From continental blocks to regional blocks. The general pattern just described is well known, but a number of points need to be clarified and refined. First, putting Europe and the Americas together as a single Western bloc simplifies the presentation, but is largely artificial. Europe attained its maximal economic weight on the eve of World War I, when it accounted for nearly 50% of global output, and it has declined steadily since then, whereas America attained its peak in the 1950s, when it accounted for nearly 40% of global output. Furthermore, both Europe and the Americas can be broken down into two highly unequal subregions, a hyperdeveloped core and a less developed periphery. Broadly speaking, global inequality is best analyzed in terms of regional blocks rather than continental blocks. This can be seen clearly in PDF Table 1.1, which shows the distribution of global output in 2012. All these numbers are of no interest in themselves, but it is useful to familiarize oneself with the principal orders of magnitude. The population of the planet is close to 7 billion in 2012, and global output is slightly greater than 70 trillion euros, so that global output per capita is almost exactly 10,000 euros. If we subtract 10% for capital depreciation and divide by 12, we find that this yields an average per capita monthly income of 760 euros, which may be a clearer way of making the point. In other words, if global output and the income to which it gives rise were equally divided, each individual in the world would have an income of about 760 euros per month. The population of Europe is about 740 million, about 540 million of whom live in member countries of the European Union, whose per capita output exceeds 27,000 euros per year. The remaining 200 million people live in Russia and Ukraine, where the per capita output is about 15,000 euros per year, barely 50% above the global average. The European Union itself is relatively heterogeneous. 410 million of its citizens live in what used to be called Western Europe, three-quarters of them in the five most populous countries of the Union, namely Germany, France, Great Britain, Italy, and Spain, with an average per capita GDP of 31,000 euros per year, while the remaining 130 million live in what used to be Eastern Europe, with an average per capita output on the order of 16,000 euros per year, not very different from the Russia-Ukraine bloc. The Americas can also be divided into distinct regions that are even more unequal than the European center and periphery. The U.S.-Canada bloc has 350 million people with a per capita output of 40,000 euros, while Latin America has 600 million people with a per capita output of 10,000 euros, exactly equal to the world average. Sub-Saharan Africa, with a population of 900 million and an annual output of only 1.8 trillion euros, less than the French GDP of 2 trillion, is economically the poorest region of the world, with a per capita output of only 2,000 euros per year. India is slightly higher, while North Africa does markedly better, and China even better than that, with a per capita output of 8,000 euros per year. China in 2012 is not far below the world's average. Japan's annual per capita output is equal to that of the wealthiest European countries, approximately 30,000 euros. But its population is such a small minority in the greater Asian population that it has little influence on the continental average, which is close to that of China. Global inequality, from 150 euros per month to 3,000 euros per month. To sum up, global inequality ranges from regions in which the per capita income is on the order of 150 to 250 euros per month, sub-Saharan Africa, India, to regions where it is as high as 2,500 to 3,000 euros per month, Western Europe, North America, Japan. That is, 10 to 20 times higher. The global average, which is roughly equal to the Chinese average, is around 600 to 800 euros per month. These orders of magnitude are significant and worth remembering. Bear in mind, however, that the margin of error in these figures is considerable. It is always much more difficult to measure inequalities between countries, or between different periods, than within them. For example, global inequality would be markedly higher if we used current exchange rates rather than purchasing power parities, as I have done thus far. To understand what these terms mean, first consider the euro-dollar exchange rate. In 2012, a euro was worth about $1.30 on the foreign exchange market. A European with an income of 1,000 euros per month could go to his or her bank and exchange that amount for $1,300. If that person then took that money to the United States to spend, his or her purchasing power would be $1,300. But according to the Official International Comparison Program, ICP, European prices are about 10% higher than American prices. So that if this same European spent the same money in Europe, his or her purchasing power would be closer to an American income of $1,200. Thus, we say that $1.20 has purchasing power parity with 1 euro. I used this parity rather than the exchange rate to convert American GDP to euros in PDF Table 1.1. And I did the same for the other countries listed. In other words, we compare the GDP of different countries on the basis of the actual purchasing power of their citizens, who generally spend their income at home rather than abroad. The other advantage of using purchasing power parities is that they are more stable than exchange rates. Indeed, exchange rates reflect not only the supply and demand for the goods and services of different countries, but also sudden changes in the investment strategies of international investors and volatile estimates of the political and/or financial stability of this or that country, to say nothing of unpredictable changes in monetary policy. Exchange rates are therefore extremely volatile, as a glance at the large fluctuations of the dollar over the past few decades will show. The dollar-euro rate went from $1.30 per euro in the 1990s to less than 90 cents in 2001, before rising to around $1.50 in 2008 and then falling back to $1.30 in 2012. During that time, the purchasing power parity of the euro rose gently from roughly $1 per euro in the early 1990s to roughly $1.20 in 2010. See PDF figure 1.4. Despite the best efforts of the international organizations involved in the ICP, there is no escaping the fact that these purchasing power parity estimates are rather uncertain, with margins of error on the order of 10%, if not higher, even between countries at comparable levels of development. For example, the most recent available survey shows that while some European prices, for energy, housing, hotels, and restaurants, are indeed higher than comparable American prices, others are sharply lower, for health and education, for instance. In theory, the official estimates weight all prices according to the weight of various goods and services in a typical budget for each country. But such calculations clearly leave a good deal of room for error, particularly since it is very hard to measure qualitative differences for many services. In any case, it is important to emphasize that each of these price indices measures a different aspect of social reality. The price of energy measures purchasing power for energy, which is greater in the United States, while the price of healthcare measures purchasing power in that area, which is greater in Europe. The reality of inequality between countries is multidimensional, and it is misleading to say that it can all be summed up with a single index leading to an unambiguous classification, especially between countries with fairly similar average incomes. In the poorer countries, the corrections introduced by purchasing power parity are even larger. In Africa and Asia, prices are roughly half what they are in the rich countries, so that GDP roughly doubles when purchasing power parity is used for comparisons rather than the market exchange rate. This is chiefly a result of the fact that the prices of goods and services that cannot be traded internationally are lower, because these are usually relatively labor-intensive and involve relatively unskilled labor, a relatively abundant factor of production in less developed countries, as opposed to skilled labor and capital, which are relatively scarce in less developed countries. Broadly speaking, the poorer a country is, the greater the correction. In 2012, the correction coefficient was 1.6 in China and 2.5 in India. At this moment, the euro is worth 8 Chinese yuan on the foreign exchange market, but only 5 yuan in purchasing power parity. The gap is shrinking as China develops and revalues the yuan. See PDF figure 1.5. Some writers, including Angus Madison, argue that the gap is not as small as it might appear, and that official international statistics underestimate Chinese GDP. Because of the uncertainties surrounding exchange rates and purchasing power parities, the average per capita monthly incomes discussed earlier, 150 to 250 euros for the poorest countries, 600 to 800 euros for middling countries, and 2,500 to 3,000 euros for the richest countries, should be treated as approximations rather than mathematical certainties. For example, the share of the rich countries, European Union, United States, Canada, and Japan, in global income was 46% in 2012, if we use purchasing power parity, but 57% if we use current exchange rates. The truth probably lies somewhere between these two figures and is probably closer to the first. Still, the orders of magnitude remain the same, as does the fact that the share of income going to the wealthy countries has been declining steadily since the 1970s. Regardless of what measure is used, the world clearly seems to have entered a phase in which rich and poor countries are converging in income. The global distribution of income is more unequal than the distribution of output. To simplify the exposition, the discussion thus far has assumed that the national income of each continental or regional grouping coincided with its domestic product. The monthly incomes indicated in PDF Table 1.1 were obtained simply by deducting 10% from GDP to account for depreciation of capital and dividing by 12, In fact, it is valid to equate income and output only at the global level and not at the national or continental level. Generally speaking, the global income distribution is more unequal than the output distribution, because the countries with the highest per capita output are also more likely to own part of the capital of other countries, and therefore to receive a positive flow of income from capital originating in countries with a lower level of per capita output. In other words, the rich countries are doubly wealthy. They both produce more at home and invest more abroad, so that their national income per head is greater than their output per head. The opposite is true for poor countries. More specifically, all of the major developed countries, the United States, Japan, Germany, France, and Britain, currently enjoy a level of national income that is slightly greater than their domestic product. As noted, however, net income from abroad is just slightly positive and does not radically alter the standard of living in these countries. It amounts to about 1 or 2% of GDP in the United States, France, and Britain, and 2 to 3% of GDP in Japan and Germany. This is, nevertheless, a significant boost to national income, especially for Japan and Germany, whose trade surpluses have enabled them to accumulate over the past several decades substantial reserves of foreign capital, the return on which is today considerable. I turn now from the wealthiest countries taken individually to continental blocs taken as a whole. What we find in Europe, America, and Asia is something close to equilibrium. The wealthier countries in each bloc, generally in the north, receive a positive flow of income from capital, which is partly cancelled by the flow out of other countries, generally in the south and east, so that at the continental level, total income is almost exactly equal to total output, generally within 0.5%. The only continent not in equilibrium is Africa, where a substantial share of capital is owned by foreigners. According to the balance of payments data compiled since 1970 by the United Nations and other international organizations, such as the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, the income of Africans is roughly 5% less than the continent's output, and as high as 10% lower in some individual countries. With capital's share of income at about 30%, this means that nearly 20% of African capital is owned by foreigners. Think of the London stockholders of the Marikana platinum mine discussed at the beginning of this chapter. It is important to realize what such a figure means in practice. Since some kinds of wealth, such as residential real estate and agricultural capital, are rarely owned by foreign investors, it follows that the foreign-owned share of Africa's manufacturing capital may exceed 40 to 50% and may be higher still in other sectors. Despite the fact that there are many imperfections in the balance of payments data, foreign ownership is clearly an important reality in Africa today. If we look back farther in time, we find even more marked international imbalances. On the eve of World War I, the national income of Great Britain, the world's leading investor, was roughly 10% above its domestic product. The gap was more than 5% in France, the number two colonial power and global investor, and Germany was a close third, even though its colonial empire was insignificant, because its highly developed industrial sector accumulated large claims on the rest of the world. British, French, and German investment went partly to other European countries and the United States, and partly to Asia and Africa. Overall, the European powers in 1913 owned an estimated one-third to one-half of the domestic capital of Asia and Africa, and more than three-quarters of their industrial capital. What forces favor convergence? In theory, the fact that the rich countries own part of the capital of poor countries can have virtuous effects by promoting convergence. If the rich countries are so flush with savings and capital that there is little reason to build new housing or add new machinery, in which case economists say that the marginal productivity of capital, that is, the additional output due to adding one new unit of capital at the margin, is very low, It can be collectively efficient to invest some part of domestic savings in poorer countries abroad. Thus, the wealthy countries, or at any rate the residents of wealthy countries with capital to spare, will obtain a better return on their investment by investing abroad, and the poorer countries will increase their productivity and thus close the gap between them and the rich countries. According to classical economic theory, this mechanism, based on the free flow of capital and equalization of the marginal productivity of capital at the global level, should lead to convergence of rich and poor countries, and an eventual reduction of inequalities through market forces and competition. This optimistic theory has two major defects, however. First, from a strictly logical point of view, the equalization mechanism does not guarantee global convergence of per capita income. At best, it can give rise to convergence of per capita output, provided we assume perfect capital mobility, and even more important, total equality of skill levels and human capital across countries. No small assumption. In any case, the possible convergence of output per head does not imply convergence of income per head. After the wealthy countries have invested in their poorer neighbors, they may continue to own them indefinitely, and indeed their share of ownership may grow to massive proportions, so that the per capita national income of the wealthy countries remains permanently greater than that of the poorer countries, which must continue to pay to foreigners a substantial share of what their citizens produce, as African countries have done for decades. In order to determine how likely such a situation is to arise, we must compare the rate of return on capital that the poorer countries must pay to the rich to the growth rates of rich and poor economies. Before proceeding down this road, we must first gain a better understanding of the dynamics of the capital-income ratio within a given country. Furthermore, if we look at the historical record, it does not appear that capital mobility has been the primary factor promoting convergence of rich and poor nations. None of the Asian countries that have moved closer to the developed countries of the West in recent years has benefited from large foreign investments, whether it be Japan, South Korea, or Taiwan, and more recently China. In essence, all of these countries themselves financed the necessary investments in physical capital, and even more, in human capital, which the latest research holds to be the key to long-term growth. Conversely, countries owned by other countries, whether in the colonial period or in Africa today, have been less successful, most notably because they have tended to specialize in areas without much prospect of future development, and because they have been subject to chronic political instability. Part of the reason for that instability may be the following. When a country is largely owned by foreigners, there is a recurrent and almost irrepressible social demand for expropriation. Other political actors respond that investment and development are possible only if existing property rights are unconditionally protected. The country is thus caught in an endless alternation between revolutionary governments, whose success in improving actual living conditions for their citizens is often limited, and governments dedicated to the protection of existing property owners, thereby laying the groundwork for the next revolution or coup. Inequality of capital ownership is already difficult to accept and peacefully maintain within a single national community. Internationally, it is almost impossible to sustain without a colonial type of political domination. Make no mistake, participation in the global economy is not negative in itself. Autarky has never promoted prosperity. The Asian countries that have lately been catching up with the rest of the world have clearly benefited from openness to foreign influences. But they have benefited far more from open markets for goods and services and advantageous terms of trade than from free capital flows. China, for example, still imposes controls on capital. Foreigners cannot invest in the country freely. But that has not hindered capital accumulation, for which domestic savings largely suffice. Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan all financed investment out of savings. Many studies also show that gains from free trade come mainly from the diffusion of knowledge and from the productivity gains made necessary by open borders, not from static gains associated with specialization, which appeared to be fairly modest. To sum up, historical experience suggests that the principal mechanism for convergence, at the international as well as the domestic level, is the diffusion of knowledge. In other words, the poor catch up with the rich to the extent that they achieve the same level of technological know-how, skill, and education, not by becoming the property of the wealthy. The diffusion of knowledge is not like manna from heaven. It is often hastened by international openness and trade. Autarky does not encourage technological transfer. Above all, knowledge diffusion depends on a country's ability to mobilize financing, as well as institutions that encourage large-scale investment in education and training of the population, while guaranteeing a stable legal framework that various economic actors can reliably count on. It is therefore closely associated with the achievement of legitimate and efficient government. Concisely stated, these are the main lessons that history has to teach about global growth and international inequalities. Chapter 2. Growth, Illusions and Realities. A global convergence process in which emerging countries are catching up with developed countries seems well underway today, even though substantial inequalities between rich and poor countries remain. There is, moreover, no evidence that this catch-up process is primarily a result of investment by the rich countries in the poor. Indeed, the contrary is true. Past experience shows that the promise of a good outcome is greater when poor countries are able to invest in themselves. Beyond the central issue of convergence, however, the point I now want to stress is that the 21st century may see a return to a low-growth regime. More precisely, what we will find is that growth has in fact always been relatively slow, except in exceptional periods, or when catch-up is occurring. Furthermore, all signs are that growth, or at any rate its demographic component, will be even slower in the future. To understand what is at issue here, and its relation to the convergence process, and the dynamics of inequality, it is important to decompose the growth of output into two terms, population growth and per capita output growth. In other words, growth always includes a purely demographic component and a purely economic component, and only the latter allows for an improvement in the standard of living. In public debate, this decomposition is too often forgotten, as many people seem to assume that population growth has ceased entirely, which is not yet the case. Far from it, actually, although all signs indicate that we are headed slowly in that direction. In 2013 to 2014, for example, global economic growth will probably exceed 3%, thanks to very rapid progress in the emerging countries. But global population is still growing at an annual rate close to 1%, so that global output per capita is actually growing at a rate barely above 2%, as is global income per capita. Growth over the very long run. Before turning to present trends, I will go back in time and present the stages and orders of magnitude of global growth since the Industrial Revolution. Consider first PDF Table 2.1, which indicates growth rates over a very long period of time. Several important facts stand out. First, the takeoff in growth that began in the 18th century involved relatively modest annual growth rates. Second, the demographic and economic components of growth were roughly similar in magnitude. According to the best available estimates, global output grew at an average annual rate of 1.6% between 1700 and 2012, 0.8% of which reflects population growth, while another 0.8% came from growth in output per head. Such growth rates may seem low compared to what one often hears in current debates, where annual growth rates below 1% are frequently dismissed as insignificant, and it is commonly assumed that real growth doesn't begin until one has achieved 3 to 4% a year, or even more, as Europe did in the 30 years after World War II, and as China is doing today. In fact, however, growth on the order of 1% a year in both population and per capita output, if continued over a very long period of time, as was the case after 1700, is extremely rapid, especially when compared with the virtually zero growth rate that we observe in the centuries prior to the Industrial Revolution. Indeed, according to Madison's calculations, both demographic and economic growth rates between year 0 and 1700 were below 0.1%. More precisely, 0.06% for population growth and 0.02% for per capita output. To be sure, the precision of such estimates is illusory. We actually possess very little information about the growth of the world's population between 0 and 1700, and even less about output per head. Nevertheless, no matter how much uncertainty there is about the exact figures, which are not very important in any case, there is no doubt whatsoever that the pace of growth was quite slow from antiquity to the Industrial Revolution, certainly no more than 0.1 to 0.2% per year. The reason is quite simple. Higher growth rates would imply, implausibly, that the world's population at the beginning of the Common Era was minuscule, or else that the standard of living was very substantially below commonly accepted levels of subsistence. For the same reason, growth in the centuries to come is likely to return to very low levels, at least insofar as the demographic component is concerned. The Law of Cumulative Growth. In order to understand this argument better, it may be helpful to pause a moment to consider what might be called the Law of Cumulative Growth, which holds that a low annual growth rate over a very long period of time gives rise to considerable progress. Concretely, the population of the world grew at an average annual rate of barely 0.8% between 1700 and 2012. Over three centuries, however, this meant that the global population increased more than tenfold. A planet with about 600 million inhabitants in 1700 had more than 7 billion in 2012. See PDF Figure 2.1. If this pace were to continue for the next three centuries, the world's population would exceed 70 billion in 2300. To give a clear picture of the explosive effects of the law of cumulative growth, I have indicated in PDF Table 2.2 the correspondence between the annual growth rate, the figure usually reported, and the long-term growth multiplier. For example, a growth rate of 1% per year will multiply the population by a factor of 1.35 after 30 years, 3 after 100 years, 20 after 300 years, and more than 20,000 after 1,000 years. The simple conclusion that jumps out from this table is that growth rates greater than 1 to 1.5% a year cannot be sustained indefinitely without generating vertiginous population increases. We see clearly how different choices of time frame lead to contradictory perceptions of the growth process. Over a period of 1 year, 1% growth seems very low, almost imperceptible. People living at the time might not notice any change at all. To them, such growth might seem like complete stagnation, in which each year is virtually identical to the previous one. Growth might therefore seem like a fairly abstract notion, a purely mathematical and statistical construct. But if we expand the time frame to that of a generation, that is, about 30 years, which is the most relevant timescale for evaluating change in the society we live in, the same growth rate results in an increase of about a third, which represents a transformation of quite substantial magnitude. Although this is less impressive than growth of 2 to 2.5% per year, which leads to a doubling in every generation, it is still enough to alter society regularly and profoundly, and in the very long run, to transform it radically. The law of cumulative growth is essentially identical to the law of cumulative returns, which says that an annual rate of return of a few percent, compounded over several decades, automatically results in a very large increase of the initial capital, provided that the return is constantly reinvested, or at a minimum, that only a small portion of it is consumed by the owner of the capital, small in comparison with the growth rate of the society in question. The central thesis of this book is precisely that an apparently small gap between the return on capital and the rate of growth can, in the long run, have powerful and destabilizing effects on the structure and dynamics of social inequality. In a sense, everything follows from the laws of cumulative growth and cumulative returns, and that is why the reader will find it useful at this point to become familiar with these notions. The stages of demographic growth. I return now to the examination of global population growth. If the rhythm of demographic growth observed between 1700 and 2012, 0.8% per year on average, had started in antiquity and continued ever since, the world's population would have been multiplied by nearly 100,000 between 0 and 1700. Given that the population in 1700 is estimated to have been approximately 600 million, we would have to assume a ridiculously small global population at the time of Christ's birth, fewer than 10,000 people. Even a growth rate of 0.2% extended over 1700 years would imply a global population of only 20 million in year zero, whereas the best available information suggests that the figure was actually greater than 200 million, with 50 million living in the Roman Empire alone. Regardless of any flaws that may exist in the historical sources and global population estimates for these two dates, there is not a shadow of a doubt that the average demographic growth rate between 0 and 1700 was less than 0.2%, and almost certainly less than 0.1%. Contrary to a widely held belief, this Malthusian regime of very low growth was not one of complete demographic stagnation. The rate of growth was admittedly quite slow, and the cumulative growth of several generations was often wiped out in a few years by epidemic and famine. Still, world population seems to have increased by a quarter between 0 and 1,000, then by a half between 1,000 and 1,500, and by half again between 1,500 and 1,700, during which the demographic growth rate was close to 0.2%. The acceleration of growth was most likely a very gradual process, which proceeded hand in hand with growth in medical knowledge and sanitary improvements. That is to say, extremely slowly. Demographic growth accelerated considerably after 1700, with average growth rates on the order of 0.4% per year in the 18th century and 0.6% in the 19th. Europe, including its American offshoot, experienced its most rapid demographic growth between 1700 and 1913, only to see the process reverse in the 20th century. The rate of growth of the European population fell by half, to 0.4% in the period 1913 to 2012, compared with 0.8% between 1820 and 1913. Here we see the phenomenon known as the demographic transition. The continual increase in life expectancy is no longer enough to compensate for the falling birth rate, and the pace of population growth slowly reverts to a lower level. In Asia and Africa, however, the birth rate remained high far longer than in Europe, so that demographic growth in the 20th century reached vertiginous heights, 1.5 to 2% per year, which translates into a five-fold or more increase in the population over the course of a century. Egypt had a population of slightly more than 10 million at the turn of the 20th century, but now numbers more than 80 million. Nigeria and Pakistan each had scarcely more than 20 million people, but today each has more than 160 million. It is interesting to note that the growth rates of 1.5 to 2% a year attained by Asia and Africa in the 20th century are roughly the same as those observed in America in the 19th and 20th centuries. See PDF Table 2.3. The United States thus went from a population of less than 3 million in 1780 to 100 million in 1910. and more than $300 million in 2010, or more than a hundredfold increase in just over two centuries, as mentioned earlier. The crucial difference, obviously, is that the demographic growth of the New World was largely due to immigration from other continents, especially Europe, whereas the 1.5 to 2% growth in Asia and Africa is due entirely to natural increase, the surplus of births over deaths. As a consequence of this demographic acceleration, global population growth reached the record level of 1.4% in the 20th century, compared with 0.4 to 0.6% in the 18th and 19th centuries. See PDF Table 2.3. It is important to understand that we are just emerging from this period of open-ended demographic acceleration. Between 1970 and 1990, global population was still growing 1.8% annually, almost as high as the absolute historical record of 1.9% achieved in the period 1950 to 1970. For the period 1990 to 2012, the average rate is still 1.3%, which is extremely high. According to official forecasts, progress toward the demographic transition at the global level should now accelerate, leading to eventual stabilization of the planet's population. According to a UN forecast, the demographic growth rate should fall to 0.4% by the 2030s and settle around 0.1% in the 2070s. If this forecast is correct, the world will return to the very low growth regime of the years before 1700. The global demographic growth rate would then have followed a gigantic bell curve in the period 1700 to 2100, with a spectacular peak of close to 2% in the period 1950 to 1990. See PDF Figure 2.2. Note, moreover, that the demographic growth anticipated for the second half of the 21st century, 0.2% in the period 2050 to 2100, is entirely due to the continent of Africa, with annual growth of 1%. On the three other continents, the population will probably either stagnate, 0.0% in America, or decrease, negative 0.1% in Europe and negative 0.2% in Asia. Such a prolonged period of negative demographic growth in peacetime would be unprecedented. See PDF Table 2.3. Negative demographic growth? These forecasts are obviously rather uncertain. They depend first on the evolution of life expectancy, and thus in part on advances in medical science, and second on the decisions that future generations will make in regard to childbearing. If life expectancy is taken as given, the fertility rate determines the demographic growth rate. The important point to bear in mind is that small variations in the number of children couples decide to have can have significant consequences for society writ large. What demographic history teaches us is that these childbearing decisions are largely unpredictable.